suppose a culture insists on the second-class status of women. This sort of inequality is one of the building blocks of many societies. The inequality is justified only if there are sufficiently good reasons for it. That most men, even most women, think it okay doesn't make it okay. They could be mistaken. Members of a subordinated group may come to identify with the interests of their oppressors. That doesn't prove the merits of the system. It proves, if anything, only the extent of the indoctrination that's allowed the oppressive regime to flourish.
The hypothetical example of a culture based on the notion that women are second-class citizens raises the question, are some moral views better than others? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Are there moral standards not of our own making? How can we know what is absolutely right and wrong? Where do moral standards come from? If there are moral absolutes, what are they? Our guest is Russ Schaefer Landau, professor of philosophy at the UW-Madison and the author of Moral Realism and Whatever Happened to Good and Evil.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You start your book with a reference to 9/11. Can you talk about that and the relationship between that event and the writing of this book about good and evil?
Well, I wrote the book several years ago in the wake of 9/11, and I was prompted to write it by having had really a long series of thoughts about whether morality was objective or not. And it struck me that the events of 9/11 were paradigmatically evil. And I wanted to be able to vindicate that thought against those who had a more relativistic bent about ethics, those who thought that what's morally right and wrong depends on the prevailing attitudes of those in a society. So that although some people celebrated those who flew planes into buildings as heroes, I certainly didn't. I know many others didn't. And I wanted to find a way to vindicate the idea that there were standards of right and wrong that obtained independently of what I was thinking or what people who thought like me were thinking. And that was the impetus of the book.
And how do you get around that if we're taking 9/11 as an example or even as the prime example? How do you get around the notion that by some moral standard, if it is a moral standard, that was a positive act by people who were waging war in a war that had no uniforms and no boundaries?
Well, the ethics of war are complicated. There's no doubt of that. But it seems to me that there are some things that are paradigm instances of immorality. And intentionally killing as many innocent people as possible seems to me to be that sort of paradigm.
Well, let's talk about why we even need to sort of revisit the idea of good and evil. You suggest in your book that it sort of went away, that it wasn't fashionable anymore to talk about good and evil. Can you kind of go back in time and look at what happened to good and evil and why you even felt the need? I mean, that's the title of your book, Whatever Happened to Good and Evil. That implied it used to be there and then it disappeared.
That's right. Well, for a very long time, people weren't afraid to be using the terms good and evil or rely on the notion of objective standards of morality. And then as we became more sensitive to the different ways that folks in other cultures operate, we lost confidence in a lot of our moral vocabulary, and we moved to, in an effort to be more tolerant of differences, especially cultural differences, we lost our confidence in our moral vocabulary. And what I'm trying to do is say that we should reinstate that confidence, all the while being wary of committing the kind of hubristic errors and thinking that our way is the only right way. I'm not counseling that, but I am saying that when it comes to promoting values like tolerance, for instance, and open-mindedness, the best way to conceive of those values is as of objectively correct values, not values that are just correct for us.
You're trying to tease out from this mass of values and ethical precepts those things which are, as you say, based on hubris or some kind of cultural provincialism from those things which are absolute to all cultures?
That's exactly right. A lot of people use the term universal values. I think I'm happy to do that as well, but I want to issue a little warning. When people talk about universal values, the first thing they do, rightly, because they're being philosophical in that case, is they try to think up of counterexamples, cases where if I say it's a universal value
right.
that we oughtn't to kill innocent people, well, folks will say, well, look, people over there did it, and people over there did it. There are lots of instances, so it's not a universal value. I'm trying to defend the idea of universal values not in the sense of a value that every single human being through all time has endorsed. There aren't any such. But rather, a set of values that apply equally well to all human beings, even those who reject them.
Now, you do get into some tough judgment calls, though, do you not? I mean, we could all come up with some fairly realistic scenarios, I think. For example, again, a wartime situation. I'll say World War II. Where you have liberation forces, let's say in France, and they're moving in secret, of course. Secrecy is a big part of successful warfare. And 8-year-old girl comes biking by, happens to see these forces in hiding. The decision is, what do we do with this 8-year-old girl? An innocent, to be sure. But then there's so much riding on her not revealing the presence of these troops.
Yeah. Well, you're asking a hard question. It's a little unfair this early in the interview. But so here's what I – without giving – without trying just off the cuff to give an answer to that really difficult question, let me just take a step back and say how I generally try to think about questions like that. The first thing is this. Suppose that ethics weren't objective. Suppose that what's right and wrong or good and evil is in the eye of the beholder or is just relative to each culture. In that case, it's actually quite easy usually to make determinations of what's right and wrong. You just do a gut check if, you know, if ethics is all, quote, subjective or if it's all relative to culture. You just think, well, what does my society really stand for? I think that questions of the sort you've just asked are actually much more difficult to answer than that. And the explanation is precisely because we don't always have the right answers in ethics. And what explains that is the fact that we don't get to make up what's right and wrong. There are a set of objective standards, and it's sometimes really hard to know what they are, or in many cases, it's not so hard to know what they are, but it is hard to know what they call for in specific cases like the sort you've just described, where we have a conflict of values.
Right.
We want to protect innocent life, that of the 8-year-old girl. We want to protect many innocent lives as well. We want to advance the causes of a just campaign here in liberating Europe. How do we balance values that probably we all recognize to be legitimate values? That's a really hard question.
Weighing one against the other.
The balancing questions are always the hardest questions. But what I want to say is, what are we balancing here? What we're balancing is a set of values that are objective. I keep using that term. All I mean is that they're legitimate, they're justified independently of personal opinion, including this author's personal opinion. I recognize my own fallibility.
It's hard. Is it hard to separate yourself from these calls?
It's not that difficult because I have recognized often enough in the past that I've been wrong about about moral issues. And that's part of my brief, really. If ethics is objective, there's a lot more room for us to be making mistakes about what's right and wrong. And so there's commensurately a larger mandate for us to be humble, actually, as opposed to what, you know, thinking about ethics as subjective or relativistic.
I would think that this topic, obviously, it sort of runs up against the province of religion, too, because good and evil, whether you are a sinner, whether you're going to heaven and hell, you know, many religions spend a lot of time on that question. And you have one section of your book that looks at the relationship between belief in the existence of God and the ability to tell good and evil. But before we get to that, can we just talk a little bit about the province of philosophy and the province of religion in determining good and evil?
Yeah, we could spend the whole hour, if you'd like, talking about that. I guess my view is this. In the book, I come down on the following line, namely that there is an objective set of standards of good and evil, of morality generally. And various religions might align more or less well with those standards, but religious views don't have the ultimate authority in ethics. Are those the phone lines I'm hearing ringing, angrily ringing off the hook?
Well, let's take polygamy as an example.
Let's take polygamy.
Some religions, let's say the Mormon religion or certain practices in Africa and elsewhere, would argue that there is that you could have multiple wives playing multiple roles. Other groups will say that that's wrong. That's evil.
Yeah. There's a lot to say about this particular example, but let's bring it back to the general question of how do we make a determination about whether or not the specific views advanced by any given religion or really any given person are plausible. What we can do is, in cases in which we disagree with someone, say, about the legitimacy of polygamy, we can ask them for their reasons to support this. And if we have problems with it, what we can do is we can say that, as a matter of fact, where polygamy is practiced, women, what that does is reinforce the subordinate roles of women in that society. And that's a really bad thing because women are, morally speaking, the equals of men.
However, what if? And I don't know if this was actually the situation with the Mormons or not, but what if you were in a fairly isolated population that had 10 women to every man?
Yeah. Norman, you're always asking these tough questions. That's very like the oil fields in North Dakota, as I understand them right now, for instance. Well, what I want to say is that, again, I don't want to try to issue some kind of definitive answer to this difficult balancing question right off the cuff, but I'd say that when it comes to balancing these considerations, we really have no alternative but to try to reason our way through to an answer. Now, what do we do when we reason our way through to an answer? What we do is, in the first instance, we try to identify what the reasons are on behalf of a given practice and then what they are in opposition. And then we try to see whether or not those who advance a particular position, whether that position really can be sustained. Does it depend, for instance, on lots of false factual beliefs, as the preservation of slavery for so many hundreds of years did? There are a whole bunch of pseudoscientific studies, books, pamphlets, articles, speeches given that enlisted alleged facts that turned out to be completely baseless, that were meant to support on scientific grounds the mental and the psychological and the moral inferiority of blacks. Now, when you advance a moral position on the basis of false facts, rooting those facts out will do a lot to undermine that kind of position. I'm not saying that's going to work in every instance, but that's the first step. The second step, then, is if we can clear away all the factual misinformation, then we have to say, on what basis are you, for instance, advocating a policy that turns out to leave women practically no options but to remain bound to the man with whom she is married, along with many other women, to force women into positions in which they will have to forego education, forego various career opportunities and things like that, when you're not making those sorts of you're not imposing those sorts of restrictions on men? That kind of differential treatment always calls out for a kind of justification. I'm not saying it could never be given. I'm saying that that's the initial step in the kind of argument.
That's the premise.
Some of what you're saying reminds me of passages in Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham Jail, where he's trying to figure out, when do you break the law and when do you follow it? And he distinguishes between just and unjust laws. And the just laws are ones that are moral, that are applied equally to all groups, and that are not degrading to any group of people. But it seems like a similar thing where you're looking at, you know, is there a kind of moral law that you can look to?
Yeah. And I'm not saying it's easy to discern all the contours of the moral law, but I am saying it's plausible to think that there are some starting points. Like, here's a starting point. You treat everyone equally until there are good reasons for treating them differently. Now let's take a look at, I'm not saying that people actually adhere to this, there's, you know, but I think they ought to adhere to it. And I think it's a plausible basis for starting your moral thinking. And then when you see policies like polygamy or like the Jim Crow laws that impose segregation, you ask, you can see what's happening is that different groups are being treated differently. Now let's step back and say, are there any plausible justifications for this differential treatment? If so, what are they? Let's hear the arguments for them.
So where do you start with a list of what would you say would be absolute moral precepts?
Yeah, well, I have some qualms about using the term absolute because that has a certain kind of connotation. The connotation is that if you've got an absolute moral value or moral precept or moral rule, it may never permissibly be broken. And I think it's very hard to find rules like that. I think instead that most moral rules are rules that hold almost always or at least in many cases. They're plausible. It's plausible, for instance, to think that whenever you receive a gift from a kind-hearted individual, there's some reason to be grateful for that gift, some reason to express gratitude. Might there be rare cases of the sort that Norman can think of where it wouldn't be appropriate to express that gratitude? Probably. But there's always something appropriate to doing that. There's always some reason, for instance, to refrain from harming other individuals.
Right.
Could that be overridden? Yeah. Sometimes we have to justly punish individuals, for instance. So what I think of, I think is that there actually there's a battery of moral precepts, perhaps none of which are absolute. Now, that's a bit controversial within ethics. There are a lot of moral philosophers. In fact, one way I think of moral philosophy is as the search for the ultimate supreme absolute principle, where we have all these different moral views and what we try to do is unify them under a single reigning absolute rule. I'm not myself that sympathetic with that picture.
It's a tall order.
It's a very tall order, but it's a natural way to be thinking about things. Philosophers, just like psychologists or physicists, are always interested in trying to come up with a unifying theory.
Yeah.
There's all this different phenomena. If they could come up with the grand theory, that would be a beautiful thing.
Well, okay. So, I mean, you start with, I mean, the closest I guess I've ever heard to one statement that would, cover in a very general, leaky kind of way all human interrelationships would be the golden rule.
I knew you were going to say that. Okay. So we've all heard about the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. The problem is that's, you said leaky. I love that because it is leaky. The golden rule, in fact, does not work as a supreme moral principle. There are exceptions to it. And if there are exceptions, then it can't really be the rock bottom basic rule. So I'll just give you one exception. Suppose you're a masochist and you like being hit. That doesn't give you license to go around hitting other people, even if you're in that. In so doing, you're doing unto them as you'd like to have them do unto you. So.
Well, here's another question. What about someone who commits an act that we might see as immoral or evil, but they're doing so because they are finding themselves in an environment that is inherently unjust? And that's sort of the Les Mis question, where he steals a loaf of bread because his sister's family is hungry and then is punished. So if I steal something because my family is poor, is my act of theft evil?
Oh, now Emily's getting into the hard question business. Well, there's not going to be one answer for all cases like that, I think. I think what we can say is that it's plausible. It's a plausible principle to say that we ought to respect the property rights of other people. Now, given what I just said about 5 minutes ago, I don't think that property rights are absolute. I think there are cases in which it's morally acceptable to violate people's property rights. If you own a cabin in the woods, I'm hiking and I'm beset by a snowstorm, and I have a choice. Either break down your front door, let's say you're not in the cabin, okay, so you can't give me permission to come in. My thought is it's okay to break down your front door to save my own life, and let's say the life of those who are hiking with me. That's a violation of your property rights. So property rights are not absolute. Nevertheless, there's something there's something amiss with what I'm doing. I owe you compensation. I owe you an apology. And what explains why I owe you those things is precisely because you've got a right. And in ordinary circumstances, it would be the right thing for me to respect that right. But here's an unusual case.
Well, I'm kind of hearing, somebody who's pretty radical about it saying, well, hey, you stole that property from the Indians in the first place. It doesn't really belong to anybody except the person who's there right now.
That's a way to argue. I don't think it's a very plausible way to argue. But what would we have to do to figure it out? I think we'd have to be willing to spend more than 2 minutes trying to figure it out in the first case. So what we need to do is we need to get our facts in order. We'd have to say, well, how did you get title to that land in the first place? Was it legitimate? Imagine that although you bought the land from somebody else and she bought it from somebody else, and that goes back five generations, 6 generations ago, someone stole that land.
Right.
Does that thereby undermine your rights to that land? That's another really hard question. I think we should be really wary of issuing snap judgments about hard questions like that. And if I might just put in a plug for my own view about the objectivity of ethics, imagine that ethics really were determined in the following way. What's right and wrong is basically whatever I think it is. And of course, you may think things very differently from me.
Right.
And that's perfectly fine. We each have our own standards. No one's right. There are no objective standards. In that case, if you wanted to try to resolve a difficult question like the one you started with 20 minutes ago, what to do with that 8-year-old girl, or what to do here when the history of title is not fully clear. In that case, all we need to do in order to resolve the ethical question of what's right in this situation is think about how we feel about it. That's it. Our feelings would be determinative. And I have a problem with that, not because I think that our feelings and emotions have no role to play in morality and moral thinking, but rather because I think that our feelings and emotions are sometimes unreliable, and they are not in fact determinative of what's right and wrong. They don't have the final say in what's right and wrong.
Well, let me throw a real wild card into the deck then. So what about, and you hear people and extreme situations debating this, what about cannibalism?
Yummy. Yeah, what about cannibalism? Let's see. Shall I say I'm against it? Well, if we're talking, I'm hungry and I'm just thinking, well, should I make myself a sandwich or should I kill my next door neighbor and eat him? It's pretty safe to say I go with the former option. But what you're imagining is something like the situation that the Donner Party faced.
Exactly.
Yeah, where it's either I eat the flesh of another human being or I die myself. Then my own view about this is that it wouldn't be appropriate to kill that other human being.
Right.
If the other human being is dead, then it's appropriate to sustain yourself by eating that dead person's flesh. Now, you might recoil in horror and people might be turning off their sets right now. But what I think is that the preservation of innocent human life is of paramount moral importance. And there are lots of taboos associated with our treatment of the dead. My own view is that it's very difficult to explain how we can actually harm the dead.
Right.
And so in that specific kind of case, what I'd say is that the preservation of innocent human life is more important. But that's a conclusion. I haven't really given you anything like a full argument.
Well,
for that
the argument that was made, if you want to call it that, in the case of the soccer team that was in the plane crash, South America, was that, well, it's no different from an organ transplant. It is a part of that person you're taking out to save a life.
Yeah.
And that person is already dead.
Yes. I think really the crucial thing is that person's already dead. Yeah, and it's harder, of course, if the person is alive.
Which is what happened in Leningrad during World War II.
Yes, that's right. And because it's so much harder, I'm going to punt on it.
We'll be back with more on Good and Evil when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Russ Schaefer Landau, and we're asking whatever happened to good and evil, which leads to a broad, free-ranging philosophical discussion. And when I say philosophical, of course, I can't leave out religion, or in the case of atheists, the lack of religion or the denial of religion. So what does an atheist do if there are no absolute rules set down by dogma, by religious doctrine? What is an atheist supposed to do to come up with these concepts of good and evil?
Well, a lot of people think that what atheists do in that case is click their heels and say, woohoo, we're free to do whatever we want. So there's this Dostoevsky quote, if God is dead, then everything is permitted. And that sort of encapsulates this idea that the only way there could be an objective morality is if it's underwritten by God's authority. I reject that line of thinking. So what my view is that ultimately moral standards do not come from God say so. I think my view about that is actually fairly standard within philosophy, and it's thought of as semi-heretical outside of philosophy. The standard view, if you're a theist, that is someone who believes in God, is this, that with regard to morality, there is a source of morality. Morality is objective. That's a set of standards that's true or false independently of any individual say-so.
Sort of like maybe what? Some of the Ten Commandments.
That's right. And the standard theistic view is that the objectivity of morality comes from God's say-so. God invented morality. There was a point, maybe contemporaneous with the creation of human beings, maybe before that, where God laid down the law. And prior to that point, there was no morality.
Right.
My thought, and again, this is not original with me, this is a standard thought among philosophers, even among theologians now, is that kind of picture is deeply problematic for those who believe in God. And the best way to conceive of a morally good, perfect God is as one who is omniscient, so all-knowing, and morally perfect, incapable of doing any wrong. The way you get those two features for God, omniscience and moral perfection, is by endorsing the existence of a set of moral precepts or moral principles that are eternally true. God didn't make them true, but God, because God's infallible, knows all the truths there are, including all the moral truths. And God, because God's benevolent, lets us know what they are, but God's not the inventor.
And God is not the intervener either? I mean, because we get into this, it seems to me, big question, and I think it has created many an atheist, of if God is morally perfect, then how can he enable such an imperfect, a morally imperfect world to exist in which, you know, my son is killed by a street gang, or some accident has taken my daughter.
Or there's some tremendous natural disasters, tsunamis and earthquakes. How could there be such terrible evil in the world, such suffering?
That's a terrific question that I am not going to answer. You will have to have another philosopher or me at another point. That's the so-called problem of evil. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, it's the biggest impediment to endorsing theism. Whether it's an absolute impediment, that's another question. It's one of those really difficult questions.
Was it Alexander Pope who said, you know, just to justify the ways of God to man, bottom line is whatever is right.
Yes.
it may appear very imperfect through your imperfect eyes, but somehow it is perfect.
Yeah, that's a classic classic defense in theology or theodicy, an attempt to vindicate the justice of God in the face of all the horrors here on earth. I mean, if you think of God in the form of a father figure or some kind of parent figure, and then you imagine a parent who knows about the vulnerability of his children and is all-powerful, or, you know, at least for current purposes, and can intervene so as to prevent the harm, and if it's the case that his children are undeserving of suffering, then you'd think if the parent is really all those things, loving, powerful enough, well enough informed, then the parent would intervene to prevent the disaster. That's not what we see here on Earth, and that raises a real challenge for theism. A challenge, as I say, that I'm not going to try to answer here.
Yeah. Now, in your book, you suggest that whether you are an atheist or a believer in God, that you still can come to an understanding of good and evil, that you don't need to solve the problem of God in order to understand good and evil.
Yeah. So you can take it from one of two directions. Suppose that you believe in God, you're a theist. As I say, I think that the best way to preserve the idea that God is all-knowing and all-good is to say that there is a set of eternal moral truths that God knows and then conveys to us. Why do I say that? Because imagine that God really did just invent right and wrong. In that case, God would be looking at instances, for instance, of torture and rape, and before having issued any moral decrees, God would be looking at those actions and seeing nothing wrong with them at all. That's, for me, that's really hard to believe. Instead, it seems to me most natural to say, oh, God, because God is all-knowing, God sees that those sorts of actions are wrong, and because God cares about us and wants us to follow in the path of virtue, we'll be the intervener, as you put it, Norman, will be the infallible conveyor of that truth and let us know that that sort of behavior is wrong. Now, if you take it flip side from the atheist point of view, a lot of atheists become skeptical about morality because they think that the only way there could be objective morality is if God underwrites it. But if the line of argument I've just given is plausible, that's a line that supports the idea that there can be eternal moral truths that God did not write up or author. And to the atheist, I just say, look, I think that you folks endorse the idea of lots of objective laws that don't have authors, like the laws of physics, for instance, or the laws of logic. And so you shouldn't hold the laws of morality to an elevated standard. You should think that, yeah, there are plenty of laws that are objective, that no one needed to have written or authored or legislated in order for them to be really valid.
Is there a problem with the dichotomy that is being set up here? In other words, good and evil? You talk about, for example, the obvious difference between an Adolf Hitler and a Mother Teresa. We would all recognize that. But most people are somewhere in the middle, or you have a problematic figure like Thomas Jefferson with the Declaration of Independence and all men are created equal but owning slaves. I mean, most people are a mixture of good and evil, and many decisions are not all or nothing. Is part of the problem that we have this dichotomy of good and evil, heaven and hell, right and wrong, and that, you know, so much of human life is a gray area?
I wouldn't say that's a big problem. I would say that what you've just said is absolutely right. And what we need to do is we need to recognize that there are such things as, say, paradigm instances of good and paradigm instances of evil, and most human beings don't exemplify those paradigms. They're somewhere in the middle. But they're in the middle between these, say, two points of a spectrum that we should recognize as being legitimate. And I think where the problem comes in is in trying to issue sort of all-in judgments about a person's character. So was Jefferson, all things considered, really a good person or a bad person? That question may not actually make a lot of sense. What would make a lot more sense, I think, was this. In what ways was Jefferson a morally good person? And there are ways in which he was. But in what ways was he a bad person? And there are ways in which he was a bad person as well. And then we get back to the point that we've been coming back to a few times, and that's how do you balance these different assessments, the good versus the bad assessment? And that can be difficult and sometimes impossible to do.
Now, if we're talking about good and evil, whatever happened to good and evil, there is this, I believe it's called the privative theory of good and evil, that just says that evil is the absence of good, that there's some kind of a vacuum there. How would that fit into the scheme of things?
Well, that's a specific – I don't myself think much of that kind of view, but I'm not arguing against that in my book. What I want to say – the big point I want to get across in the book is this, that there are – standards of goodness, and there are standards of badness that run all the way to evil. There are standards of moral right and wrong, and we don't make those standards up. If we're sensitive enough, if we're discerning enough, we can understand and appreciate what those standards are. As far as what specific standards of goodness are, I'm not trying to give a list at the end of this short book of here are the precepts you ought to live by. I'm going to leave that to wiser folk myself.
Well, let me ask you about the question of tolerance and good and evil, because that's perhaps where a lot of us maybe stopped using all or nothing terms. Let's say there's a woman sitting in front of you with a burqa on, and in her culture, that is what she is trained to wear. Yet if you apply the standard that women should be treated equally, that would not fit her situation. Isn't it a sort of no-win situation where if you judge the burqa as an evil garment, then you're culturally insensitive and you're passing judgment? But if you don't, if you act like it's fine, then you're being blind to a kind of repression.
That's very well put, and I think you're right about that. With regard to tolerance, I think that one big explanation for the gradual loss of confidence in the use of our moral vocabulary, especially talk of good and evil, is precisely the fact that many people think that if you endorse a view like mine, according to which there are objective standards of good and evil and right and wrong, you'll be forced to become dogmatic about them, and you'll be forced into a position of intolerance. And in fact, although I think that's wrong, if you think back through history and ask yourself, who were the worst moral monsters ever? These are all people who have a view about morality like mine. They're all people who think that there's truth with a capital T. They're all people who think that there is that there are standards of right and wrong that obtain objectively. And they think they've found them, and they think that having found them, that licenses them to force those standards down the throat of those who disagree. Now, I don't think that's right in most cases, although I do think that intolerance is sometimes appropriate. We oughtn't to have been tolerant of what the Nazis did. We oughtn't to have tolerated the kind of intensely violent and prejudicial actions of the Malian insurgents in Mali when they went in and started cutting people's hands off for violations of what they interpreted as Sharia law. We shouldn't be tolerant of those kinds of actions. So not everything is rightly tolerable. But that said, if you think that tolerance is really important, that maintaining an open mind and not being dogmatic is really important, as I do, let me just ask, are those important just for people who already endorse those values? Or is tolerance and open-mindedness important for everyone? I would say that tolerance and open-mindedness are, in the sense I initially used, a universal value, not in the sense that everyone respects those values, but in the sense that those values are appropriately applied to everyone. Everybody should be non-dogmatic, open-minded, and tolerant. As I say, there are limits to tolerance, and exactly where to draw those lines, that's a very difficult question.
Well, you could have, in fact, we do have people who don't necessarily have a dogmatic approach to life, don't necessarily believe in their precepts that might be different from ours, might just be simply, well, sociopaths. I mean, you know, think of, I mean, what I would come up with first would be Stalin, for example. You know, killed or had killed how many of his own countrymen, and probably didn't really have any particular moral precepts of any kind in mind, just perhaps at the most something that was efficacious at the moment or even a whim.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I'm not saying that the very worst moral monsters had a perfect – had a coherent moral ideology that they then sought to impose on everyone else. Some folks may well have just had ruthless pursuit of self-interest, and there's nothing even superficially moral about that. And Stalin is a really good candidate. There are other moral monsters who talked in explicitly moral terms and laid out a vision that they described as moral, and they used that as a way of causing the death of millions of people.
Back to Mein Kampf. Yeah, laid out, okay, this needs to be done, this needs to happen for the good of some whatever people are chosen.
Yeah.
What about the question of our relationship to the animals? Because, for example, I was just talking to Jean Ferraca about a trip she made to the Galapagos Islands where they watched a particular bird where it gives birth to two eggs, and then the one that hatches first kills the sibling, and the mother helps then toss the rejected sibling out of the nest. Mm. Now, if you apply...
That's sad.
It is sad. Nature is cruel. We've all seen the cruelty of nature in terms of the survival of the fittest. You know, and you talk in your book at times about the sort of the egotism, ethical egotism, where we're out for ourselves and a lot of the decisions we may make are self-interested. But, I mean, how do you sort of look at the fact that we are part of the sort of animal world, yet we're trying to be different?
That's a great question. We're animals, so we can't escape our animal nature, but we are different from all the animals we know of, at least. I'm not an animal ethologist, so maybe I'm going to be corrected by those who work with dolphins or with higher primates. I don't know how the minds of those animals work, but to my limited knowledge, we're unique among animals in our capacity for extended reflection and deliberation. So we all have our various animal urges to go to the bathroom, to eat, to have sex, to be warm, to be physically comfortable. But we're not forced to succumb to all of those animal urges. We're capable of stepping back and reflecting on the wisdom of indulging in those animalistic pressures and inclinations. And that's something that no other animals can do, to my knowledge. And that ability to step back and be reflective and critical about whether to indulge our animal appetites is really key. So we can't look to other animals necessarily as models for how we ought to behave. The story you just gave is an excellent example of that. Instead, what we can do is we can say, look, we are all given to certain innate urges that are given by our bodies and our, quote, animal nature. But then should we indulge in them? Just because, for instance, let's assume that men are by nature highly competitive, or by nature have a desire to have sex with as many people as possible. Just because – I'm not saying that's true, but let's just assume that were true. That doesn't mean that, morally speaking, it's okay to go ahead and do that and to force yourself on as many – for a man to force himself on as many people as possible just because that's what, quote, nature tells him to do. We're capable of stepping back from our so-called natural imperatives, questioning the wisdom of doing that. And that's what that's one thing that morality does. It imposes constraints on what we are naturally inclined to do.
And why?
Well, in part because it can. I mean, although we are animals, like I said, we have this special capacity. Morality doesn't apply. I don't think morality applies to worms. I don't think it applies to birds. I don't think it's right to say of a bird, oh, what you just did, you mother chick, what you just did was deeply immoral. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Apologize to the owner of that car.
Yeah. I don't think it makes sense to say things like that. And then, and why doesn't it make sense? It's precisely because these sorts of beings are not capable of stepping back and reflecting on the wisdom of their actions. They're not capable of asking, is it a wise thing to do to indulge my appetites in this way? But we are. Because we're relevantly different in that way, we are bound by a different set of principles.
More on good and evil when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Russ Schaefer-Landau, and we are talking about his book, Whatever Happened to Good and Evil. Toward the end of your book, you talk about values for good and evil and how it really is not something that science can solve. We're used to kind of looking to science to answer kind of all our questions. And you say this is something outside of the province of science.
I know. It sounds mysterious, and a lot of scientists don't like this. A lot of scientists are – not a lot, but there's a little cottage industry of those who are trying to fully explain the nature of morality. I think that that enterprise is never going to succeed. There's an old distinction that the Scottish philosopher David Hume drew in the 18th century between that which is and that which ought to be. And he was puzzled about how it can be that we can discover what we morally ought to do just by issuing a series of descriptions or factual statements about what is the case. I think what science is designed to do is to tell us what is the case. About the nature of our world and about more largely the nature of our universe. It can focus very narrowly all the way down at the level of the cell or the subatomic particle, all the way broadly to the nature of galaxies. One thing I don't think it can do is tell us what's right and wrong and what's good and evil. And in part that's because it's not to denigrate science, it's just to identify its limits. So what science is in the business of doing is trying to uncover the laws that regulate the way the universe actually operates. But think about what a so-called moral law, or better, I like the term that Norman used, a moral precept. Think about what it's trying to do. It's not trying to describe the way things actually behave. Like the way people actually behave. It's rather trying to prescribe the way that we ought to behave. And a moral precept or moral principle or moral rule can be legitimate even if it fails to accurately summarize the behaviors or the activities of human beings. So, for instance, I think that there is a legitimate moral precept that commands us to give to those who are much needier than ourselves, and to help those who are in very vulnerable situations, especially if that kind of help comes at almost no cost to ourselves. But think about all the people who have failed to adhere to that precept. There are lots of them, and I myself have failed to adhere to it in many cases. I don't give to charity all the time, for instance. Now, that doesn't make the precept any less plausible or any less legitimate, right? But if you came up with a scientific theory about the nature of subatomic particles and you were then in a position through, say, various experiments to determine that those particles didn't operate in the way that that your scientific theory said that they do, that casts real doubt on the theory. But that very few people give to charity, that doesn't cast doubt on the moral precept to give to charity.
Well, William Blake would argue that we wouldn't need charity if all were as rich and as happy as we were.
Well, William Blake is right. But of course, here in this real world that's hardly a utopia, in which there are great divisions of social status and wealth and various opportunities, we are unfortunately in a position of having many people who are at the very bottom rung of the social ladder, and they need a lot of help from us.
So Ebenezer Scrooge, when he's reformed, gives the turkey. He gives a turkey, but he doesn't really gives a little raise.
That's a little. He goes a little way towards redemption. He's not all the way there.
Becomes a much less interesting character somehow. when he is quote perfect. Okay, how about this as a precept? Greatest good for the greatest number.
It's a good rule of thumb. It doesn't always work, and that's precisely because it can license us in ignoring the needs of the worst off. What we can do in many cases is to serve the interests of those who are rather comfortable, and especially in cases in which there are only a few at the bottom. The greatest benefit for the greatest number principle may license us in ignoring the needs of the worst off. And that seems to me to be morally problematic.
What about the problem of sort of who gets to perceive these moral precepts, that if we – are you arguing a kind of philosopher king?
As the chair of the philosophy department at the University of Wisconsin, I am indeed arguing that, no, I'm just kidding. Scratch that. No, I'm not arguing for a philosopher king. What I think, in fact, is that the precepts that I regard as universal are knowable by everyone. Now, I do think that, and this points to something that you mentioned, Emily, earlier, that some people come from various sorts of disadvantaged backgrounds. There are lots of different kinds of disadvantage. I think that one of them is moral. I think it's possible, in fact, it's actual, for people to be raised in communities, in societies, in countries that have certain kind of governing principles that are themselves deeply immoral, that stand, for instance, for the validation of oppression and intolerance.
Been done before, yes.
It has indeed. And I think that it's, of course, it's easier to assimilate the values of your own culture than to break away from them. So in some cases, it's much more difficult to come to an appreciation of what's right and wrong than in other cases. That said, I think with the right kind of upbringing and or education and or open-minded reflective spirit, we can all come to an appreciation of what's right and wrong.
Whatever happened to good and evil, are they still there?
They're still there.
Are they solved?
They are not solved. That would put the philosophy department out of business.
You think of biting into the apple and getting, you know, the knowledge of good and evil, do we have that knowledge?
I think we often do have that knowledge. Is it complete knowledge? No. It's imperfect, but it's much of it, almost all of it, is accessible, and we actually do know a good deal of it.
Well, thanks for sharing some of it with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Our guest has been Russ Schaefer-Landau. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.